good evening. This is Disability and Progress. Thank you for joining us. We bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. And thank you to Matt and Annie, who are the engineers of this episode. Also, Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Thank you to her. If you want to be on my email list, I want to remind you, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Also, it is pledge drive tonight, so please feel free to join us and support us. And you can do that by going to kfai.org. Tonight's topic, beep baseball. Joining us to talk about that is a handful of people. We have Janet Leonard. Janet is a longtime sighted volunteer spotter and current tournament committee member. Good evening, Janet.
Hi, Sam.
And also joining us is Greg Gunterek. Greg is a longtime player and Hall of Fame member inductee in 2016. Good evening, Greg.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
Good. And last but certainly not least is Jared Woodard. Jared is a many-time championship pitcher and PR director and second vice president of the National Beep Baseball Association. Good evening, Jared.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having us.
Hopefully I got all those little titles correct. I do have one question, Jared. How many times championship?
Five.
Think about it. Jeez. Well, congratulations on that one. Thank you all for agreeing to join me. I have had one experience of beep baseball, but I hear a lot about it. And of course, I have been there once or twice. So I thought it would be good for people to understand a little bit more about the game. But before we get into that, can you each take turns and please give us just a little bit of history about you, like how you got involved in beep baseball? Let's start with you, Jared.
Yeah, so I got involved with beep baseball because it's really been a family tradition. Growing up, my dad has been playing, you know, for over 30 years now. And so him and then several of my uncles and cousins and my grandparents always volunteered for beep baseball. So it was just kind of always a summer vacation for us where we got to go enjoy the sport. And so that's really how I got involved, is that I was really just born into it.
Greg, how about you?
Well, I found out about beep baseball on a training class with my Social Security Administration. I went down for training and I was introduced to it by somebody in the Dallas area, and that was 38 years ago, and I'm still playing. I'm very happy. I love the game.
Janet, your turn.
I came to baseball in 1986. My gosh. Through a family member. At the time, I was living in Denver, Colorado, and Denver was one of the early teams, not an original, but a very, very early team. Mm-hmm. And I started volunteering for them as a sighted spotter and have been to every World Series since. And again, it's a wonderful opportunity every summer to travel and see friends in the sport.
I'd like someone to give me some history of how beep baseball got its start. Anybody?
I can give you a start. It was developed by a telephone pioneer by the name of Charlie Fairbanks in Colorado, back around starting in 1964. The first formal team games were played in 1975. In Minneapolis and very shortly thereafter, St. Paul. He developed the beep baseball for educational and recreational purposes. The game looked a little different then than it does now, but basically the ball was the same. It's a 16-ounce softball with the sound chamber in it that it emits a beep. And the bases back then were more traffic cone like for children. But as adults tend to do, they saw a good thing and said, huh, we need to modify this game of an audio ball for blind children and turn it into a recreational sport for adults. So it took off and it came through Minneapolis and St. Paul and Chicago. But the telephone pioneers were very pivotal in the startup of it. And they were retirees from the telephone company. Well, not always retirees, but employees and retirees. And they have been very supportive of the game ever since, including continuing to manufacture the beat baseballs to support the sport. And they do that out of a volunteer organization in Denver, Colorado.
Excellent. So now I want somebody to describe like what beep baseball is. How do you play it?
Well, I'll try to describe as best I can.
Okay.
Beep baseball is a game with naturally two teams, and you have six players on each team. You have six on defense, and the batter is has the pitcher and the catcher, which is on his side, is on the offensive side. So the pitcher is trying to let the batter hit the ball, and there's a sequence to it where he says ready, set, pitch, and once that happens, the batter swings the bat, and the pitcher tries to get the ball to where the bat is coming through so the batter can hit it. Once he hits it, it has to travel 40 feet, and he has to run to a base. There's two bases only. There's not three. There's a first base and a third base.
Oh.
Once, and the base is about, 48, 50 inches high, and he tries to get there before any of the fielders picks up the ball. If he gets to either of those bases, which is turned on, if he gets to the base, it's a run. And if the with the fielder picks up the ball prior to the runner getting to the base, it's an out. There are three outs to an inning, and six innings in a game. If either Jared or Janet could add to that, you can do that.
Yeah, I think you nailed it home pretty good. And you know, as Janet mentioned at the beginning, as you mentioned, I guess about Janet, she is a spotter, and so you know the spotters are in the field, and so they do call a zone to where the ball is hit. But the goal is basically just to get the ball off the ground away from the body before the runner gets to the base.
And what kind of sound do the bases make?
So the bases are a buzz, and the ball is a beep. So you can differentiate the two.
And is the ball a constant beep, or is it have intervals?
Yeah, is intervals, but it always beeps until you put a pin in it.
I was just wondering.
The bases are activated by a base operator who's seated behind home plate with the scorekeeper, and it's a random. The batter doesn't know if they'll be running to first or third base. And it is activated at this on contact with the ball. A good base runner can run in between 4 and 5 seconds, the 100 feet down to the base. These guys can fly. And that's not a lot of time to hit a well-hit ball. As Greg mentioned, it has to go a minimum of 40 feet, but many, many hits go anywhere from 80 to 170 feet easily. the spotter is allowed one number one time, one through six, but only that one number one time. Fielders can talk to each other as needed, and they often do, to assist in the, making the play. But there's a lot of on-the-ground body blocking. People aren't catching fly balls. That's a rarity in our sport. The base itself, I might add, is about a, it looks like a football tackling dummy thing. What do you call those? 8-inch round, 4-foot high cylinder implanted in a 1-by-1-foot foam cube that they run for and tackle in an effort to beat the fielder fielding the ball.
Let's talk about a body block. What is that, and what instance would you do that in?
Well, the body block is basically when the ball is hit and the spotter yells out a number, the fielder goes to the fielder or fielders go to that area where the ball is going. And you're not picking up the ball like a regular infielder. You're diving for it, and you're blocking it with your body as best you can. And, you know, you stretch out and try to stop the ball from getting past you. And once you do that, you could pick it up and hopefully get that runner out. So it's not, you know, bending over and scooping the ball like, you know, regular infielders do. This is the more area you can lay out on the ground, the better chance it is to block that ball.
How do you avoid collisions if you call more than one player and you both can't see?
Well, the spotter only calls one number.
Ah,
so
okay.
That one number, the fielders in that area, a place to run to, and they run laterally. They're supposed to run laterally, side to side, and not necessarily front and back. You go back too far or you go up too far and you might collide, but usually the really good teams have practiced a long time with each other, so they know how far to run and from side to side and how far back or forward they can go also.
Yeah, go ahead, Janet.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, to go along with what Greg said, there's certainly a lot of time that's put in as far as practice in order to avoid those types of collisions in the field. And you kind of do, you're listening to the ball, but for most players, you can kind of hear footsteps in the grass to know that somebody's getting close. And if there's something that is going to be an obvious collision, then spotters like Janet, or even umpires or even pitchers, would of course, you know, yell stop in order to prevent a noticeable collision from happening.
All right.
But the real bottom line that people want to know about baseball, though, is how do blind people hit a baseball? And that is the art that Jared has perfected, which is done with an audible cadence. And I'll let him expand on that. But he's only 20 feet from the batter, who is, again, on his team. They are not in opposition. The pitcher and the catcher are sighted working with the batter with a 4-1 strike count, 4 strikes and 1 passed ball. And he uses an audible cadence for his batter. If you want to expand on that, Jared?
Yeah, sure. So, like she mentioned, there's an audible cadence. And so myself, I say set, ready, pitch. And then it's like a timing mechanism for them, a rhythm for them to know when to swing and expect the ball to be there. Others, pitchers say ready, set, ball or set, ready, ball. But the really the big thing is that you have to say some form of ready and some form of pitch in order not just for your hitter to know when the ball is coming, but also for the defense to know. So she also mentioned that you're on the same team. So in baseball, kind of the goal is you want to, the ball is coming in and you have to take the bat and put it where that ball is anticipated to be. In beat baseball, it's a little different in that really players train to make their swing as consistent as possible. And so they want a swinging in the exact same spot every time. And so then the pitcher basically is the one that would pitch to that spot. And the timing is kind of between the pitcher and the hitter at that point. And it's kind of like a good flow in a relationship that you create. And it does take a lot of practice, just as defense does and everything else that we have talked about. A lot of hours are put into to be able to get that rhythm down with your hitter.
Janet, did you get that beat baseball yet? Maybe not.
Okay. Yes, I do.
Oh, you do. Okay. So I would like to, if it's possible, hear what the beat baseball sounds like so people can hear that.
Sure. It's going to sound like a Labrador at the moment, but apologies. Here we go. I'll try not to have it too loud.
Ah. And so it does that beep, 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 beep. Do you ever?
Yes.
I was wondering, like, I would be worried that you'd kind of miss, you'd get between the beeps, you know, when it's coming towards you. But I suppose it beeps fast enough that you should be able to line your bat up to the sound where it's coming from if you're going by sound.
Well, the batter isn't listening to the ball. The batter is listening to Jared. It's strictly the timing of the audio cadence. Actually, most teams practice with dead balls.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Well, because they're expensive, even though they're made and sold at cost, a beeping baseball can cost $35. These guys can muscle the ball, and a well-clocked ball that goes 120, 150 feet, sometimes the electronics in the ball fail.
Yes, understandably so. Jared, were you able to pull up a sound of a bass?
I was not able to find a good clip of that yet.
Okay, that's fine. So I just want an understanding, but we've got audible baseballs, audible bases, and there's no second base. That's a difference, right? So what are some of the, I want to talk about the differences between the, quote, baseball game and this. So you have the audible stuff. You take out the second base, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so you, I think one of the bigger ones, like Greg had mentioned, is that you pitch to your own team. And then also another big one is that in baseball, there's home runs, right? You hit it over the fence. There's a fence in the outfield. Well, our home run line is at 170. They're pretty rare when you see them. But in baseball, if it goes in the stands or past that fence, you can't make a play on it. In beat baseball, that ball can roll well out past 170 feet, and you can still play that ball and put somebody out.
Ah, okay. Any other things?
Well, the game is 6 innings and the pitch count is four strikes and one ball.
Four strikes, yeah. And it would usually be three?
Three strikes, four balls, but we don't have walks.
Gotcha.
In baseball.
So let's talk about who is eligible to play beep baseball. Do you have to be visually impaired? Can you be sighted? How does this work?
Yeah, so you do have to be considered visually impaired. In other words, you know, the kind of universal definition of 20 over 70 or less than 30 degrees of your visual field in your best eye with correction. So there is that. So basically visually impaired, but kind of another unique thing about beat baseball as far as a sport for people who are blind and visually impaired is that, such as Janet and myself, you do play alongside sighted individuals. So the pitchers and the spotters, you know, and the catcher, we're all kind of involved in the sport of beat baseball, where most other ones, it's typically where, like goal ball, there's a few people who are blind and visually impaired that are the only ones that play in the game. They don't have, you know, sighted players in the game. And so I think that's one of the unique things about beat baseball.
Well, in goal ball, you're blindfolded anyway. You can have partial vision, but you're blindfolded.
All of the fielders and the batter are blindfolded, though, to equalize. So when you're on the field of play as a defensive player, you're blindfolded, regardless of your level of vision.
And is there a rule about what kind of blindfold you must wear?
Yes, the league has about four or five different models of eye shades that they've approved, and they span kind of a range because people have personal preferences, but they're basically a large covering, either cloth or cardboardish, and we also have authorized the ski goggle coverings that people are familiar with if they play goal ball.
Gotcha. So how many teams are there in beat baseball?
That's kind of a tricky question to answer. I think that we actually had somewhere around like 32 or so registered with the NBBA as a team. However, we typically have, I would say, in between 16 and 22 or so teams show up to the World Series. But I believe there's about either four or six teams in Taiwan that play regularly beat baseball, but they only send one or two over to the World Series. And there's several in the United States that might come to the World Series one year, might not make it the other year. You know, so it really kind of varies on where the World Series is and how the funding's been going.
Okay.
We also had teams come in from Canada and from the Dominican Republic. And I think that's between Taiwan, Canada, and the Dominican Republic. I think those are the only three other teams outside the United States.
And so, okay, let's talk about tournaments. Now, don't count this year because this is a weird year, clearly. But in a, quote, normal year, how many tournaments do you generally have?
Well, there are regional tournaments. They're usually between, three and six, depending on who's willing to host. The World Series is held once a year, either the last week of July or the first week of August, and is awarded 2 years in advance. So people know in advance where it's going to be. This year it would have been in Ames, Iowa. We know that next year it will be in Wichita, Kansas. And we also happen to know that the following year, 2022, will be in Beaumont, Texas. But regional tournaments, vary from year to year. There's two in Texas. There's a long-running one in Jared's team's hometown of Indianapolis, Indiana. Long-standing tournament in Chicago, Illinois. And then there'll be miscellaneous tournaments. Last year, there were 22 teams at the World Series. Or excuse me, 18. The year before, it was 22. And as Jared indicated, often there are more teams registered early in the spring than actually come to the series. It is an all-volunteer endeavor and very expensive, as we know, to travel and bring a team and support staff.
So you talk about regional tournaments. What does that mean exactly? And who can go to the regional? Can anybody go to the regional tournaments who are signed up as a team? Or I should say, can any team go to any of the regional tournaments?
Any team can go to the World Series, actually. We don't have an elimination. Our regional tournaments are not elimination tournaments in preparation for the World Series. So a regional can set its own enrollment, you know, whether it's, you know, a doubleheader or 14 tournament or six or eight or whatever you can sustain.
And so then the standings of where each team lies would depend on how they did in the World Series?
That's correct. Yeah. So in a way.
Did I ask something too difficult?
No.
it's a political hot potato.
Oh, excellent. I love those.
It was.
Oh, you can take this one, Jared.
So, actually, in the 2019 World Series was the first year that we tried something different, because what you just said is typically how it's been. For instance, you know, if the New Jersey Titans got sixth at the World Series in 2019, then that's the seed that they would have coming into 2020. However, we changed it to where basically. That is taken into consideration, but so is any off-season acquisitions that you have made from, you know, players from another team or well-known players, as well as losing any players. And then also performance in the regional tournaments. So it's kind of like a committee. Yeah, it's a committee of people who consider all of those factors.
Why would they do that? Because this is like, wouldn't this be considered a its own tournament? I mean, it's kind of like you're practicing, I'm sure. I don't know what they consider the regionals. I only know it from playing how some other blind sports do it. But then it's kind of sounds like all bets are off as far as like if you place a certain place that you are actually that place in the nationals.
Well, the ranking committee actually consists of a representative from every team in the league, well, every team participating. And it's a work in progress, but they vote on it. You know, they submit their rankings by voting on it and have to justify it so that it doesn't simply become any sort of just popularity contest as opposed to skills level, that kind of thing.
So do you have just one national tournament a year?
Correct.
Okay. And how do you decide where that tournament will be held?
The tournament committee entertains bids from cities, as I said, 2 years in advance, but actually they work sometimes 3 and 4 years in advance in going to site visits for a city who has read a request for proposals and feels they meet our needs. We need a minimum amount of all grass fields, soccer being our primary preference. And at one venue is a primary preference, but as we've grown, sometimes you're hard put to find a city with, you know, 10 to 12, 14 soccer fields in one complex.
That's true. But
we've hosted, you know, in dual site. 2 years ago, we were actually in three different sites around Eau Claire, Wisconsin. But the committee sends 2 to 3 people on a site visit, sometimes 4. Members of the tournament committee to evaluate it, and they have a checklist, and they're looking at hotel accommodations, pricing, field conditions. Our needs, of course, are a little mysterious to people not familiar with the sport, and our primary one, besides the quality of the grass, is the lack of noise. We don't want to be near an interstate. We don't want to be near an airport. We don't want to be near train tracks or dump trucks on the highway. We've had quite a canal, barges on a canal in upstate New York. We've had an assortment of noise issues that, you know, is up to the committee to sort it out. We take the final three sites and evaluate it and currently present the recommendations to the board at the week of the World Series for voting on selection for a site 2 years in advance.
So we were just kind of talking a little bit about tournaments and whatnot. And Jared, you thought you found an acceptable clip maybe for to hear what the bass sounds like. Let's see if we can do it.
Yeah, so if you listen closely, you can actually hear a pitcher's cadence as well as the hit and the bass.
Set, ready, pitch.
Yeah, so I did. So the ball has that beep, 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 and the bass has a steady pitch.
So yes.
A steady pitch, so you don't hear the breaks in that. Okay, cool. Well, thank you for that. So I want to talk a little bit about how Beat Baseball, the association, has obviously must have a board. You're talking about a board. How does the board work? What are they responsible for, and how many people are on it? Anybody?
So
anybody?
It's a quiz.
So
it's a 16-member board. You can take it from there, Jared.
Okay. So, kind of, really, the one of the sole responsibilities of the board. And the tournament committee is kind of to really put on the World Series each year, you know, to make sure that there is a World Series that takes place and that our teams can come and participate in it. And so I kind of feel like that's the number one, you know, purpose of the National Beat Baseball Association and the board. But then it's also just to perform, you know, kind of outreach to spread knowledge about the sport of beat baseball and to try to allow the opportunity for as many people who are blind and visually impaired as possible to play the game of beat baseball. And so, as Jana mentioned, it's a 16-person board. And so as second vice president, it's kind of attached to the public relations committee and so the PR director. And then our first vice president is kind of attached to the tournament committee in that they're the tournament director. And so then, of course, you have the treasurer who is kind of over the fundraising portion and stuff like that. And then the secretary with keeping our membership updated. And then several board members at large that serve on different committees. Janet had mentioned the ranking committee for the seeding of the World Series, but there's also diversity committees, the Wool committee for the women of our league. There is the membership engagement to try to work on ways to engage membership when we're at the World Series. And so several different committees that board members might head up and participate on in order to try to grow the sport of beat baseball.
You find...
Oh, and we must...
Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't want to overlook... I chair the Integrity Committee, which is near and dear to our hearts, otherwise known as the Anti-Cheating Committee. But I did want to reiterate that if people are interested in seeing where teams are located throughout the country, if they go to our website, which is nbba.org for National Beep Baseball Association, they can see where teams are, and there's a team contact and email listed for each of those teams. And they can also explore Facebook and so on, depending on what teams offer.
Okay. So people cheat in beat baseball, huh?
No.
But you must have had, you feel like you need to have an integrity committee to make sure like rules are followed.
Well, as a former chair of the rules committee, yes. We're always trying to evolve rules with the game because it is an evolving game. I'm very proud to say that defenses have gotten far better over the last 20 years. The sophistication and level on defense particularly has improved. Offense always seems to improve, but it's just issues that are of concern, and the board is tasked with, you know, staying up to date, keeping the rules current, and looking at issues such as the blindfold right now is what the integrity committee is examining. And we take, you know, learn lessons from other sports, such as goalball, on how to handle various issues.
Do you have to actually be playing in the sport in order to be on the board?
I believe you do have to be a member of the National Beat Baseball Association. I don't think that you necessarily have to be an active player. There are some former players who end up just volunteering on committees and such, as long as they keep their NBBA membership up. And, you know, like Janet mentioned, with, you know, following along and taking lessons from goalball, but also, you know, cheating is kind of present in pretty much every sport, you know?
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, sad.
But unfortunately so, yeah. And another thing about keeping the rules up to date is it's not just so much about is the blindfold enough to, you know, keep people from cheating, but also one big thing over the last, I don't know, 13 years, I guess it's been now, wow, is the safety of the bats, basically, because our ball is anywhere from 14 to 16 ounces, and you can't just hit that with any old bat, and so just making sure that teams and players are using bats that are safe to hit our ball with.
Without mentioning amounts, because I ask that you don't do that, but do people need to pay in order to play in beat baseball?
Yeah, you know. Go ahead, Janet.
Well, they're modest amounts. Your team registration is due in the spring with a roster and an individual amount. But it is all volunteer, mm-hmm. and every team does their own fundraising to cover that registration fee of a couple of $100 and the individual fees. And different teams do fundraisings in different ways, but we all lean on our volunteer support, whether it's Lions Clubs, Telephone Pioneers, Rotary, city parks and recs departments, whatever it is, it's critical that we have volunteers to help with the on field and off field, because there's travel and expenses. It's an expensive sport in some ways, but on the other hand, there are very few team sports for the visually impaired, relatively speaking, to the so I'm very glad that we can offer it, and teams do find ways to fundraise.
Do you, what happens if you want to get on a team, or if you have found a team of people who want to get in and create a new team in the sport, and there's already a team in your state, how does that work?
So we do have kind of an outreach committee. And one thing that I'll say about beat baseball and the National Beat Baseball Association right now is that if there is anyone, you know, that is interested in starting a team, 90% of this league, the people that have expertise on how to do so are more than willing to offer up you know, the knowledge they have on it. But, you know, individual teams have their own guidelines as far as getting on a team. And then if there's a team that is interested in, you know, learning what it takes to join the NBBA and what it takes to develop a team, you can always just send an email to outreach@nbba.org. And, you know, our outreach committee will get with them and say, hey, you know, here's the list of items that you're going to need, the time that it's really going to take, and the effort that it's going to take to make a team successful.
So let's say we're in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Can you have two or three teams that play in the regional tournaments come from that city?
Absolutely. Yeah. Indianapolis has, we have two teams here. Chicago has had that at different points. And so that's certainly possible. And in that situation, what we would actually ask to do is get you in touch with the Minnesota Millers, which are there in Minnesota. And I'm sure that they would be willing to guide whoever it is on the path of, you know, what it takes to successfully form a team.
Greg, I want to talk to you a moment. You were inducted into the Hall of Fame. You're an inductee in 2016 in regards to Beat Baseball.
Yes.
How did that work, and what does that mean, and what was that like?
Well, it's I guess based on a lot of statistics. I made some defensive all-star teams, and I was an MVP defensive player in the World Series. And I made one, amazingly enough for me, I made one all-star team on offense. The satisfying thing about that was what my son was pitching to me.
Aww. So
that made it more notable to me. And I am a person who doesn't even think about statistics. The only thing I think about is whether the team wins or loses. I don't care, you know, about any individual statistics. I do receive them. I do have them. And I'm proud of them, but I couldn't even tell you what they were for. I won regional awards, and so when I went to the 2016 World Series, I never expected to be awarded the Hall of Fame. It was a big surprise to me. So. And it was very satisfying.
And so is this where does this reside? I mean, does somebody each year get picked from Beat Baseball, or how does that work?
Yeah. At least one person gets awarded the Hall of Fame. Sometimes there's more than one person. And I honestly couldn't tell you how many there are each year, but it goes from at least, I think, one to, I think Janet would know this, maybe two or three each year that gets this award.
The website has the listing of the awardees, and it's the head of the committee is former longtime pitcher Kevin Barrett from the Cleveland Scrappers, who tends to the history of Beat Baseball and is a wealth of knowledge.
So, Jared, I'd like to talk to you about your championship pitching. You must have quite an arm. So, how did that feel like to you when you got that, and when you, you know, each time you kind of get one of those big things, and that's quite a feat, right?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it's been kind of surreal. Like when the first championship that I won was with a team called the Kansas All-Stars. And it was made up of several individuals who have had played and beat baseball for a decade or more. And so it was really gratifying just to, and satisfying, I guess, to help them get over the hump and win their first championship. And then the same thing really with the most recent ones, winning it with my dad and helping, you know, the 30 other people that are on our roster, actually 40, I think now, but, to help them succeed, you know, and be successful and winning a game and winning a championship. It's really satisfying to win it alongside other people. I think is really what the big thing is for me to help others succeed.
Jared, how old were you when you won your first championship?
16 when I won the first one. 16.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So I don't ever want to arm wrestle you.
Well, fortunately, you don't got to be too strong to throw a beat ball because I'm not really strong. So
what is the age range of people that play currently in your beat baseball?
Oh, wow. So I would say that I know that we have a couple pitchers that are in their 50s and 60s and at least one that is in their 80s. Yeah. And so I can think of a couple players that are in their late 50s, even early 60s. And the youngest player I can think of is maybe 12 from the New Jersey Titans.
Wow.
So there's a big spread. So like, for instance, on our team, I think our youngest player is 14. Our oldest player is like 57.
Well, my research woman, Charlene, was thinking she was too old. So Charlene, toughen up, girl.
And it is co-ed.
And it is let's talk about that. So how do you keep it? Does there tend to be more men than women? Do you try to keep it equal? Are there ever teams that are all male or all female?
It's just constantly evolving. Some teams just sometimes have several women on them, and some teams had some women on them and then don't now, but there are no restrictions or quotas or mandates or in any way, shape, or form. And yeah, players range from 12 to 71 that I can think of on the field. And Greg is near the top end of that spectrum, but he's not at the top.
Oh, she's telling on you, Greg.
I know.
He is in the Hall of Fame, so.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I guess you can't have it both ways, or can you? Well, that's pretty cool. So it sounds like, do you have to have special permission to get in that young? Like, is there anything you have to do? Or is it if you're good, you're good, and you just, or if you have a desire to play, then you're welcomed in?
A parental waiver, you know. That's the same as in any sport, but no, we don't have any restrictions. It's just more up to the team. You know, some teams probably have them.
Yep, that's exactly what I was getting ready to say. I think the NBBA is like under 16, you got to have a parental waiver, I think. And I know that for instance, the Thunder, we have age restrictions on the field volunteers as well as players. That there's a certain age that if you're younger than that, you can't. I think it's like 12 and 10 or something like that.
How do you find your volunteers?
Beg, borrow, steal. A lot of our volunteers are family members who see how much the sport means to someone that they care about and get drawn in or involved. Or through publicity such as this, or through a club presentation that they heard about it at a Lions club. Someone has come in with a beat baseball and a base and is appealing for help. Or, you know, fundraiser activities where you get the word out because people want to know how blind people play baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I can actually think of an individual with the Thunder who we were just out at practice one day in a park and he came by and he's like, what's this? And then he got interested. And so now he helps out. He don't travel to the tournaments with us, but I feel like a lot of the teams throughout the league have a lot of individuals who help them with behind the scenes stuff throughout the year and still don't go to the World Series, but they most certainly help the team. Whether that's, you know, helping haul equipment or help haul players or just showing up and helping out at practice, you know, just word of mouth. And like Janet said, through events that teams do to raise money or raise awareness.
Do you feel like it is getting harder to get younger people interested in doing sports?
Actually, we've been having an influx of younger athletes over the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years or so, across our league, really. It seems like almost every team is bringing in one young person a year now, it seems like.
So where can people go to find out more about Beep Baseball? What's your website?
It's www.nbba.org. Of course, you could just Google National Beep Baseball Association. You'll probably find our Facebook page because it's called National Beep Baseball Association, or you could do at NBBA76. We're also on Twitter, National Beep Baseball Association, or at NBBA. And we also have a YouTube page where you can go in and look up some of the past championships that were filmed, and that is National Beep Baseball Association.
Any final departing words that you'd like to leave people with before you go?
Yeah, I appreciate you having us on and allowing us to talk about Beep Baseball. And I would encourage anyone who has listened to this, if you're interested in Beep Baseball, just get on nbba.org. Like Janet said, you can see if there is a local team and there will be a contact link for an email and reach out. And if nothing else, you can just send a Facebook message to our National Beep Baseball Association page and we'll get you where you need to go.
Thank you guys so very much for coming on. I appreciate it. And okay. Good luck. I know you have a tournament coming up, Bold or Crazy, one or the other. I'm not sure which. I'll refrain from my political comments, but they're both out there. Good luck with it. And hopefully next year will be a much more stable and normal year for you.
Thank you,
Sam. Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Sam.
This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFEI and or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the producer of the show. Thank you to Matt and Annie for engineering this episode. It's Matt's last time. We will miss you so much, Matt. Good luck in New York and don't do anything I wouldn't do. And since you don't know what I wouldn't do, the sky is the limit. All right. And Charlene Dahl is my research team. We have been speaking about Beep Baseball tonight, and we were speaking with Janet Leonard, who is a longtime spotter and volunteer and current tournament committee member, Greg Gunterek, who is a longtime player and Hall of Fame inductee in 2016, and Jared Woodard, who is a many-time championship five, I guess, pitcher and a PR director and a second vice president of the National Beep Ball Association.